How's Makan? Is anything new with him?
Not really. He's not bad. I think he's good.
Yeah, with the army. With the army. Anything new with the army?
Nothing good.
Nothing good yet. Okay. My grandsons are very happy. One grandson was selected. All his years in high school, he was running and doing push-ups and sit-ups. I said, what are you training for? He said, he's training for the army. So it seems the army's having 2 weeks of activity and competition. So he was selected from his unit in the Tzamchanin. So, and he tells me he's like in a hotel now. He never had it so good. He was in Wingate, the food, they're treated there. So I said to him, how good are you? He said, if you compare me to the white Israelis, I'm good. If you compare me to the Ethiopians, I'm not good. So I love that answer. What did you say? Yeah, I know. We had someone who worked there who Nebuch was deported. He was the best worker we ever had, a guy named John. And he was a marathon runner for Ethiopia, but then he had to leave, political reasons, who knows. Anyway, let's learn Torah, and we're not going to solve the world's problems, even though people, you know, like me, think they have all the answers, but a little modesty will help. Now, today, first of all, is November 14th, 2010, and I say hello to the wonderful students in front of me and to those across the world. We're dealing with the introduction to the new edition of the Besamim Rosh, and it's very fascinating. Here you have a young man. I don't know where he's at today. I've tried to locate Rav Reuben Amar, but I haven't gotten anywhere. I assume he's still among the living. Again, when this came out in 83, we're dealing with, 27 years ago. So let's say he was in his 30s, then 40s, I don't know. But here the Sfadi comes out and fights the battle in honor of the Besamim Rosh, that it's legitimate, Chas v'Chalilah, to say Reb Shirl Berlin forged it. And he takes issue with all those that think that he forged it, and you'll see certain proofs, what we spoke about last week, proofs we're going to talk about today. I think in back of it all, you have to bear one thing in mind. There's a... I refer to this and I refer to it again, and it's extremely important. The Sephardic world did not undergo the challenges that the Ashkenazic world underwent. In other words, we were challenged from the time Mendelssohn left the ghetto. We have been challenged. Those of us here from the Ashkenazic world, anything you mention, take a mechitzer in a shul. The challenges to the Ashkenazic world are indescribable. I would imagine doctorates will yet be written on the problem of mechitzer in the United States, Canada, etc. The Slavic world never had this problem. And even in 1942, when Oscar Janowski, Professor Janowski, Zichrono Levracha of the City Union College, wrote a book, he was a social scientist, and he wrote a volume on Judaism in America. He edited it. And one of the contributors was Rabbi David de Sola Poole of the Spanish Portuguese Synagogue. It's not a rare book. It could be it's online. I don't know. Maybe you can buy a used copy for people. Tell me they can buy old copies of books for a penny. You just pay for postage, could be. And so he wrote an article that Torah will have to make certain compromises in America to survive, and this was written in 42, and logically he was correct. He said that no Ashkenazi synagogue, basically, will be left with mechitzer in the United States. He said the Sephardic synagogues, like Spanish Portuguese, will have a mechitzer, not because the people are from, but because that's tradition. A synagogue has to have a mechitzer, and the Spanish Portuguese live with tradition. If you've been to Holland, how many of you have been to Holland? So one of the tourist attractions is the old Spanish-Portuguese synagogue that has no electricity in full today. It's completely lit by candles. When you ask why, tradition. We never had electricity. The synagogue was built in the 1600s. Why should we put electricity in now? It's a big tourist attraction. Danny, they're certainly not going to change it now. You know why. Because it's a tourist attraction. It's like the Ukraine. Anyone who thinks they're going to be able to take Rav Nachman's remains and bring them to Israel is foolish, because the Ukrainians will never let Rav Nachman's grave leave the Ukraine, because it brings in tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year. All right. So the Sfardim never faced these challenges. And therefore, they could take a much more positive attitude to the Summon Rosh. And when we start doing the Tshuva, maybe later today, next week for sure, you'll understand that we see it with like a boxing fight. We see the difficulty of Torah outside the ghetto. They don't comprehend that because they never faced it. And the truth is, until they reached Israel, the Sfardim were basically Shomer Shabbos. The whole breakdown, it's before Israel already. It happens in Egypt earlier because of the canal, the Suez Canal. Israel, Egypt is internationalized, if you know the history. So there already there was Chilul Shabbos 200 years ago, but 150 years ago, you already had the first Chilul Shabbos. In the Sephardic communities that we know of, Morocco and Gerber and Tunisia and Algeria and Iraq, they tell stories about the island of Gerber that there was not one Mechallel Shabbos on the entire island. Okay? Then, of course, with modernity, with Israel, with World War II, with exposure to Ashkenazim, you have a breakdown. But it comes much later than with us. And they're not attuned to all these difficulties. And you have to bear that in mind. And that's why you have to understand someone like Rav Reuven Amar, when he's Malamed Schut on the Summer Rosh and Rav Shaul Berlin, his background is such that the finesse that's needed to understand the winds that are blowing in Rav Shaul Berlin, he does not have that finesse. Ashkenazim have it, and that's why among the Ashkenazim, you saw the Chatam Sofer went crazy, called it the Kizbe Rush instead of the Kitve Rush, and you saw Rav Mordechai Benet declared him an apikores, and on the other hand, Rav Reuven Mama defends him. Now, at the end of last week's Shayur, we had a very interesting moment where he lists out all the Sfarim that the minute they came out, there was tremendous machloket about them. And I need not tell you, the Mishnah Torah is a classic example. You don't have to go any further than the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah comes out and the world caves in. Well, whatever the reasons are, part of it was the Mishnah Torah's so-called arrogance that he writes in the introduction that all need to study Shas is over, a good Jew will open up a Chumash, and from the Chumash will go to the Mishnah Torah to get the Halacha. It's when you look back at it, you have to laugh, because who could dream how much would be written on the Mishnah Torah? There's no Sefer until today, which so many commentaries have been written on. I wonder if I'm not incorrect, and maybe a biblical scholar can correct me or say I'm right, I believe there are more commentaries on the Mishnah Torah than on Tanakh per se. And so they looked at the Rambam, they attacked him, how could he say this? The Ravid calls him Meshugai Yisharuach, and then of course the philosophy of the Mishnah Torah. And you have to understand that the first four prakam minig Yisrael is we only begin studying the Mishnah Torah from Hilchit Yisodei HaTorah Perek Hei. To understand the first four prakam, I heard Shurim occasionally from the Rav on it. I have to tell you, I can understand it on a very verbal level, but the depth, I don't have to comprehend it. My son-in-law, Reb Chaim Eisen, comprehends it a lot better than I do, but he has a feel for Jewish philosophy, which I lack. I told you, I don't have any problems whatsoever, because I yet saw the Shanghai crowd. Someone who saw the Shanghai crowd didn't have to study philosophy. But I don't have to go any better than Rabbi Gilbert Klapman. Let me give you one word of background. The first doctorate done on the history of Yeshiva University was by Rabbi Gilbert Klapman. Rabbi Gilbert Klapman was rabbi of a very prominent synagogue, Bet Shalom in Lawrence, and he taught, he had a PhD in Jewish sociology, and he taught at, if I'm not mistaken, and he taught at Yeshiva College. So he did a doctorate on Bernard Revel at Bernard Revel Graduate School on the early years of Yeshiva University, 1886 to 1915. And as you know, I was privileged to stand on his shoulders and go further with the doctorate on Bernard Revel. Unfortunately, as I've cried many times, no one has written beyond what we have written as far as a scholarly history of the yeshiva. I had a whole discussion last night with some very intelligent people, and they gave me reasons why. I don't agree. I can only tell you there are problems that come up in the yeshiva's history and Rabbi Belkin's life, but there's a way to write history by being positive, and you give the facts, but you do it in a way that you can explain the human circumstances, human difficulties. But all right, what Gurek wrote is sociology, not history. I mean, he's written interesting books, The Men and Women of Yeshiva University, the sports, right, the sport book, but that's not the history. It's not Rabbi Victor Geller. I got Victor Geller's book published, wrote a beautiful memoir, but that's a memoir. It's not a scholarly history. There's a difference. You don't agree with some of his theories, but the Liechtensteins don't agree either. So you're in.
I will not say a word because he's a very fine man.
Yeah, you're in good company. But those are his theories. That's the way he understood it.
Klapperman just published a book too.
Klapperman what?
The book, The Story of Yeshiva University.
Of course, it was his doctor. It was published. I'm telling you, there are two books. There's Klapperman and there's Revel. Now, why do I quote Klapperman? Klapperman has a meritic line in there. He was a Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Rabbi Gil Klapperman has to be in his 90s today. The last time I met him about a year and a half ago in Yerushalayim, he was in wonderful health and spirit, halavai vaita. He's a wonderful person. So he has an unbelievable line in there that he says, look at the difference between Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and his son, the Rav. He said, both of them knew the Mishnah Torah by heart. The Rav knew the Moreh Nevuchim by heart. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik never picked up the Moreh Nevuchim in his life. And there's a line, I'm paraphrasing it. They say about, I don't know if it's about Rav Chaim or about the Chafetz Chaim, that a Talmud was sitting and studying the Moreh Nevuchim. So it's either the Chafetz Chaim or Rav Chaim Brisker came over and said, put the sefer down, he said. You had a father, you had a grandfather, you don't need the Moreh Nevuchim. So you see, there was a tremendous amount of opposition to the Moreh Nevuchim, and it was burned in public. I mean, it's not a happy thing to say, you know, when you burn books, you know, there's a good vart, and when you stop burning books, ultimately, you burn human beings. And I don't recommend burning a book. You can be as, excuse me? Well, we know with Hitler what happened, but it's not the way to go. When they burned Making of a Gadol in public in Matzdorf, I have to tell you, it was a frightening, frightening episode. Now, he gives a whole list of Sfarim when they came out, and everyone disagreed, and everyone fought them, and everyone burned them. We ended off the class, probably the best example was the Chayayot, the Chachmat Adam. The man's A grosser. That's what you're quoting, La Halacha. And people laughed. And I don't have to tell you, the Chayadim, until the Mishnah Brura, the whole Litvish Welt grew up on the Chayadim. So when all is said and done, he makes the case that how can you criticize Rachel Berlin? How can you criticize the Sefer? People found fault with it. And he says very clearly, they found fault with many Sfarim. That's not a Fisarim. Okay, bear in mind what I said 5-10 minutes ago. It's an Eidot HaMizrach mentality. The inner challenges he could not sense because the Eidot HaMizrach did not go through these challenges. You see, and you can understand why he was so positive. Now, he goes further, and let me pick up. As you recall, I mentioned to Rabbi Raphael Cohn that when Rav Shaul Berlin came out with that sefer against him, the whole world jumped on him and actually put him into cheirim. And I'll explain to you what's involved here. Look, in the world of lumdus, there's freedom of thought. No one in the world will come out and say that Rav Chaim had no right to be innovative. I mean, anyone who's a lumden, I'm not talking now the street crowds, or chveis the kanoyim, the zealots, chveis the block off streets in Meir Shearim, the street for men, the street for women. If you've been in Meir Shearim today, there are big signs up against zealotry and against the Syakuzim, whatever they're called. What goes on in our little Jerusalem. But no one in their right mind will come out and say that the Telusha, Rav Chaim Rabinovich, also instituted a new method of study. I gave lectures on this when we spoke about Pels and Litvashi Yeshiva years ago in the Kollel. But no one will say they didn't have a right to innovate. No one will say, for instance, if you take the Hasidic world, Rabbeinu Tzadok HaKohen, he was tremendous in his innovations, in his way of thinking. The Yishbitza, I mean, there were so many different ways to go. The Sfat Emet, freedom of thought, freedom to be machadesh, to be innovative, to come up with novellas, if I may use the proper English word for chidushim, no one will disagree with. But where you cross a line is when you're very caustic. And that's why the Ma'aneli Gerit against Rav Moshe Feinstein was immediately put into Cherem and removed from all the bookstores, because he was very sharp against Rav Moshe. His language is hypercritical. No one, you can quote his lumdus in many cases. The Ma'aneli Gerit was right. I truly, your humble servant, in certain areas I paskin exactly like the Ma'aneli Gerit, not like Rav Moshe Feinstein. You talk about Jentav Sheni, there's a classic example. But the bitter causticness was not called for. With Rav Shaul Berlin, he came out with such bitter language against Rebbe Folkhoyn. Now, he's put in the Cherem, and here's the famous letter from the Noda B'Yehuda saying that the Cherem is not a good Cherem, and he came out in public in favor of his relative Rav Shaul Berlin. Amar quotes this letter. I want to read you part of it. You decide, is this letter really supporting Rav Shaul Berlin, or is the letter simply saying that they went too far when they put him in Cherem? And here, he's writing to Rav Shaul Berlin's father, Lechvod Sheh Basari, my relative, Yedidi, Bechabibi, Harav Agon, Bechulu, and he says, I received your letter, and it makes me very sad to see this machloket. And now, this is the Noda B'Yehuda speaking. Remember what I told you last week. De gedolim, in every generation, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, I believe it's Daf Lamed Chet, Do, Vedosha, Vedo, Chachamav. All right? In every generation, you have Talmidei Chachamim. But some, ultimately, the names rise so high that 100 years later, 200 years later, 300 years later, 500 years later, everyone else is forgotten, but you're not going to forget the Noda B'Yehuda. And he says, and he says, if you ask me to express an opinion, and he says, in this generation, chutzpah sagi, there's chutzpah all over the place, v'hamaskil yidom, and someone who's intelligent has to keep quiet. And if someone would ask me, ani omer bepremalei shim yishaleni adam imukuyav lachush lecherem hahu hayiti morelo derech hara'ah she'eno mukuyav lachush klal. He says, if someone would ask me, is there really a cherem on Rav Shaul Berlin? Absolutely not. He says, the dayanim of the three communities, Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek, they went too far. They had no right to put Rav Shaul Berlin into Cherem. But he says, I do admit, he says, V'yad she'biyametu, that there was a takalat haloshon. And midaberet bizyonot al rav gadol v'lo yafeh asa mizeh bazeh. And you see, that sentence is very revealing, that the Noda B'Yehuda sense that Rav Shaul Berlin's language was too sharp. The strictures were too deep. The language, the attack. And you see from this letter, Cherem he shouldn't be in. But Ephraim, the Noda B'Yehuda, was upset with his cousin. The language was not befitting a Ben Torah. All right. Very fascinating. So he quotes the letter to show that Rav Shaul Berlin was being attacked unnecessarily. It all goes back to that original sefer against Rav Fol Cohn, Rav Fol Hamburg, the Rav of Hamburg. He quotes the Noda B'Yehuda from his point of view to support Rav Shaul Berlin. But I'm showing you, if you read the letter carefully, you can see that the Noda B'Yehuda was caught between the devil and the deep sea. You follow me, Danny? And that's that lesson. And there's a lot to be learned from here. You see, when you have a machloiket, you never win a machloiket with vinegar. It's much more intelligent to use honey. If you can use honey and make your point, but make it in a way that you're not bitter, you're not caustic, you probably will get a lot further. Can we always do this? Problem is, we're human beings. Occasionally we fly off the handle, particularly Gedolei Yisrael. I've seen Gedolei Yisrael, and at times they fly off the handle. I can record for you Gedolei Yisrael. Give you one simple example that people have asked me, and I've stated it, and I state it again, and I'm going to record it now, and you can quote me. One time, Reb Moshe's family came to see me. I don't want to go into detail now. There was a reason why. Reb Moshe wanted them to, there was a tshuva Reb Moshe was publishing, and it was about me, and he wanted them to ask my permission that I shouldn't be offended. And I told them, Reb Moshe can mention my name, I'd be the happiest guy in the world. But it was published, my name is not mentioned, it says, Echad B'Yerushalayim. I would have been much happier had Reb Moshe mentioned my name, and you would understand what's involved. But his grandson, who was a great nephew, fine Talmid Chachamim, came to see me. So he got involved in a whole talk on Reb Moshe Feinstein. By this time, Reb Moshe was on in years, and there are already rumors that the seventh volume, certain things were put in that Reb Moshe didn't write, that others put in. So we got involved in a whole discussion on Reb Moshe and the Yigra of Moshe. And Reb Moshe, his relatives told me, my grandfather's told us, of all that he has published, he regrets nothing. And he had tremendous machloket. In other words, you got to remember, with AID, they started, you know, Satma got it, was started with their tactics, calling him in the middle of the night. He had to change his phone. It was terrible what went on. They started terror tactics. Rav Moshe said, regretted nothing, except one line. You know what the line was? There's a tshuva in Orach Chaim. Someone quoted it the other day in it. In this very context of a shul, when we grew up in the Bronx, we went to shul. All right, the young Israelis inevitably had two flags up front, an Israeli flag and an American flag. And someone asked Rav Moshe about having flags in the shul. And Rav Moshe asked, and he said, you know, it's Uvda D'chol. What does a flag have to do with the shul? Up front, you have the Aron Kodesh. I mean, and I saw many shuls where on either side of the Aron Kodesh, on the right side was an American flag. I think according to American custom, the American flag has to be on the right side. Am I right? The left side? Now, when you face it, it's over here on the left. Could be. I don't remember. And on the other side was an Israeli flag, or before the State of Israel, the Zionist flag, it was called. So Rav Moshe asked, it shouldn't be, it has no place, who heard of such a thing, Hadashim Yikarev Bo. But a rabbi shouldn't lose his job over it. And then Rav Moshe has a sentence, I'm paraphrasing it, do you remember it? About the Israeli flag. Who made the Israeli flag? the tzionim, amurim, no belief, apikarsim, he maledicts them. So his children told me that was the one line Reb Moshe regretted writing. So you see, occasionally a person will fly off the handle, and Reb Moshe was very balanced. He was not one to fly off the handle. The Rav, you remember how the Rav got into such tremendous trouble? Anyone who was in yeshiva in the early 50s, we remember it like yesterday. For Pesach, the Rav gave a Pesach shir. So in the, you know, the Pesach shir, and the Gefrek Shilas, afterwards they asked the Rav questions. So it has to be about 54, can be checked out, check the New York Times, you'll get to it. So someone shot at the Rav about using corn syrup. So, corn syrup, kidney a derivative. And the Rav said, we didn't use it, and Lita, we didn't use it. Chas v'chalila, so some from the audience shoots at the Rav. What about Bartons? They use corn syrup in Pesach, it's under the OU, and the Rav parceled out the corn syrup in Bartons and lost it. The next day, Mr. Klein, the owner of Bartons, with his lawyer, were in the yeshiva lobby, right outside the Beis Medrash, going into Dr. Belkin. They threatened the yeshiva with a raise $100,000, which is like $100 million today, lawsuit. What they would lose. You don't know what went on all over New York. The Rav said, there was an ad in the New York Times, as I recall, a quarter-page ad. Rabbi Dr. Joseph P. Soloveitchik publicly states his absolute confidence in the Union of Orthodox Congregations and in their supervision for Passover, and particularly in relation to the Bartons candy, etc., etc. The next year, they didn't use corn syrup. You follow me, Ephraim? But the Rav flew off the handle. So this is what he's complaining. You see, this, he flew off the handle. But to put him in Cherem, ad kedei kach not. Okay, hold on 1 second. Ephraim, what did you want to ask?
I want to ask that you see in Rishonim sometimes they attack each other.
Right, very, you don't have to go any further than the Ravid and the Rambam. Shugai ish haruach. Right, and there's a whole list you can quote from the Ravid. So you should know, on the Litvish Welt, this was called Rittita d'Oraita, and this was the custom in Lithuania. When a Rebbe gave a shir, the top students ripped him like a lion. You have no idea what went on. And then, if the Rosh Hashiva was on the level, he fought back and ripped the hell out of the students. And this is documented. This I saw with my own eyes in Lakewood, you understand? But this is documented. That's the famous story with Reb Aaron Cutler, how he came to take Reb Dov Schwartzman as a son-in-law. Do you know the story or not? Did they tell it to you in Muncie? Or they hid it from you? It's a famous story. I know it from eyewitnesses. I heard it when I learned in Lakewood. But when I came in Aliyah, I met eyewitnesses. Reb Aaron came to Israel the first time to take over when Rabbi Zalman Meltzer died in 1953 or 54. He was appointed the titular head of Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. You know what I mean? Titular head title, because Reb Aaron couldn't come here during the year. He came in the summer, set a few shurim. So Reb Aaron Cutler, the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, Zakta Shir in Yerushalayim, so they brought him to Chevron. Chevron then was the top yeshiva in Israel, like Panovich today. Ein Kleinigkeit, Chevron on Rechov HaYeshiva, not where it is today. Today it's down the hill from here. You know where Chevron is? You've walked over the Baruch Hashem. This morning I walked on Rechov Yeshiva. I was going to my son-in-law, the dentist. He's in Haredi land, his office. His clientele is all Haredi. So I'm walking on Rechov Yeshiva. Whenever I walk on Rechov Yeshiva, that's where Chevron was, at the end of that block. There's still a branch of Chevron there today. So Reb Aaron gives shir, and sitting in back of the room is one of the top Chevroner guys, and suddenly his feet are on the desk, and he's sitting back, and Reb Aaron thunders at him, Das cheish kavod ha-teira, azay zitzman, that's the way you sit? Zehu, this is kavod ha-Torah? And he shoots back at Reb Aaron in public. a Bikatz Rosh Yeshiva, that he can't learn in, or that he can't der Rambam, that the Chopki Gebben Kavirat Teira. But for an Amar, it's Girich Nishtab Kavirat Teira. You understand what he answered him? If the Kletzki Rosh Yeshiva knew how to learn and knew this Rambam, I'd give Kavirat Teira. But for an Amaritz, I don't give Kavirat Teira. That's what he shot back at Rabarin with the Rambam, and Rabarin was. Came over to him after the Shia and said, come back to America and marry my daughter. You follow me? That's the story of Reb Dov Schwartz and Rabbi. Now, it's a long continuation to it. And in Lakewood, then I can tell you the whole story. But these are facts, 100%, that I heard when I learned in Lakewood and I heard from my witnesses.
One second.
I don't want to tell you. It's not for now. It was a tragedy because you were taking apples and pears and putting them together. She was an American girl, already had gone to college, and he was a Litvisha, a Yerushalmi, with all that that implies. But Ephraim, this was the Minhag in the Litvisha Welt. And that's what you see in the Rishonim. And that's Nachron, calm down, Reb Shaul Berlin. That's what the Noda Behuda was saying. You follow me? To go and to put him into Chayrim, not. But Ad Kedei Kach, he didn't use the nicest language. And this is Reb Shaul Berlin. And Amalam Itzchut, in one simple way, everyone loses their temper once in a while in learning. And the examples I gave you with Reb Moshe, that's a golden example. And I was told by his family he regrets nothing he published except that line. You follow me? And the Rav, I can tell you what happened with Bartlett. You can read about it in Louis Bernstein's doctorate on the RCA. But I was sitting in the audience. And we were kids, we heard corn syrup, Usa, Bartons, Usa, you know, it was unbelievable. And within 1 minute, you got to understand, New York was a small city then. If the Rub opened his mouth in YU, within 1 minute, it was all over Brooklyn. You understand? Today, I ain't maledaber, what, with an internet, with a website, what would go on? And you know what the loss would have been to Bartons? And what do you want out of Bartons? They were getting a heksha from the OU, permitted corn syrup. Not the end of the world. There were plenty of materium on May Kitniyot. But the Rav came from Litta. Litta, they didn't use May Kitniyot. You follow? All right, anyway.
They didn't have tomatoes on
Pesach. I don't know if they didn't have tomatoes. No, one second. One second. If they didn't eat tomatoes on Pesach, if I never heard garlic. I know the Litvakin. I understand. You were to Russia, I was to Russia. We know what goes on in Russia in the winter. It's snowing there already. There's endless snow on the ground. And we're here. We haven't seen a drop of rain. We're walking around the middle of November in shirt sleeves. But there's a minig not to eat garlic. I couldn't understand. Why don't Jews eat garlic? So they explained to me that they were chayshish in Litta, that someone planted chametz under the cloves of the garlic. All right, Baruch Hashem, those chashashot are very far from contemporary reality. All right, but be it as it may, a Jew is not satisfied with that chashashot. We're alive in the year 2010. I had sitkoniyot at my house last night, friends of my wife, and they told me they are so happy they can eat strawberries. You see, you know, everyone has frum relatives. You can't eat strawberries. And then they were told how to clean and you cut off and what was done dare dorot, what you can't see with the eye. And these are sincere women. The people today are not eating strawberries, not drinking water, not eating dairy products. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. We Jews, min cook, min zucht, what can I tell you? Okay, let me go a drop further. But that's the Noda B'Yehuda. And it's very powerful. The Noda Behuda is very powerful. And you can look at it either way. But Rav Reuven Amar looked at it, of course, from his point of view, that the Noda Behuda is defending his cousin, and we have no right to be negative. Okay? Yes, Nachum.
When you say that the Chum Sofer is, you
know, called them Kinsbei. Kinsbei.
Here this Reuven Amar is saying, sorry, neither of them, they're both approaching it purely based on the content of the
tshuva.
We'll come to it.
It's all here. Okay, now, he then reproduces a letter from Reb Tzvi Hirsch Berlin, a tremendous letter from Reb Shaul's father. And Reb Zvi Hirsch Berlin totally, absolutely defends his son. Not only that, he says, if you're going to criticize my son, you have to criticize me. Because this manuscript my son bought 10 years ago, it was in my house. I looked at it. I saw it. My son worked on it. He wrote the Kasada Hasana. He added to it. He wrote a super commentary. I urged him to publish. I see absolutely nothing wrong with this manuscript. And just because they attacked him earlier because of his strident language against Rebbe Rafael Cohn, but there too, the Noda Yehuda defended him, and Allah had come of a comma here where he publishes a manuscript, what right does anyone have to criticize him, to maledict him, to curse him? And I got to tell you, the end of this letter by his father, the last paragraph, you can't believe the Hebrew. It is fabulous rabbinic Hebrew, where he speaks about all those that come his son and against his son, and b'choshech shmo yechuseh, and he maledicts these people, let darkness cover them, lishanoti makbativ, make his tongue be stuck in his mouth, and it should be like a desolate tree in the wilderness, and all these people, lo yiru tov, they shouldn't see good, they should fail in their ventures. The cholosa ela, who criticized my son and cursed my son, lo yila erviona, they shouldn't have any success with their children. They should fall down. They should trip. They should rot away like grass that has no water. And their names, Yutamu Chatoyim Urishonim Odeinam. Wow, he goes on and on. It makes Rakefet pale by comparison when he would tell a BMT kid he's a rotten, malicious, hideous, heinous, ruthless, depraved, degenerate, about surreptitious, levelant, poya, pushtak, no good, bummy dog. He makes Rakefet pale by comparison. And then the blessings he gives to those who support Vatem Achayu Lumi Hayurayem Et Hashem V'charedim Al Devaro Shimu Elav Yishma Leichem Hashem L'yom HaKisei HaBalein L'Toba. It's a play on words. It's from to Rosh Hashanah. V'yekabel Tfilateinu Gam Yachad L'malot Nishalov And V'chol Acharei V'chol Ish Areyat Hashem B'yemetu B'tamim Umituvo yaspienhu barachamabu baratzon veyetla bavenu lalekat vizarchom lavo tovi ishet reyehu viyeskenum heril alot lirotu lagira ot bahal marom katsho vishum biira la avdo vaayin baayin nirehu kachafetz ebid la abde Hashem doresh tov vidoveh shalom lachol zaro. Wow. You've got to admit, the father had some magnificent command of rabbinic Hebrew, maledicting those who oppose Reb Shaul and blessing the true Yirei Hashem who join with him in supporting his son. Okay, now we come into the most interesting part of the introduction. What are the criticisms? What are the proofs? And here, you see, this lends itself to a doctorate. Literally, there's so much research that can be done here. The first topic he touches upon, and I want you to know, Reb Menachem alone touches upon this in Mishpat Ivri. There's literature on this. Reb Yitzchak Zeif Kahana, Professor Kahana, who taught at Bar Ilan. I realize that name you probably don't recognize. Anyone recognize the name Reb Yitzchak Zeif Kahana? Reb Yitzchak Zeif Kahana was an Hungarian, one of these Hungarians who knew everything. He was a great Talmud Chacham who had a doctorate and was a scientific scholar. He came out of the Holocaust, came in Aliyah, and he taught at Bar Ilan in the early years. Among his writings is Sefer Hagunah. You may have picked it up. Where he takes the Halacha de Nebenezer, Siman Yud Zayin, and he deals with it historically, gives you all the sources, gives you Shelet and Shuvat. His expertise was in responsa literature. He did many mechkarim over the years, including posthumously they published all the scholarly articles he had published. He was a very, very fascinating individual, and I'll quote him many times in future lectures after the Besamim Rosh, when we deal with the entire concept of paskening halacha and shelot and shubat and what you follow when there's machloket, etc., etc. Now, they raise a very simple problem. How can you say that this is the Besamim Rosh, that the Rosh wrote it, if at times you find contradictions between what's in the Besamim Rosh and what's in his commentary on Shas or in the Tshuvat HaRosh that have been published? And you should know that this is an entire world of scholarship. Many times you will find contradictions between his commentary on Shas and his Tshuvat. Now, this is a very fascinating question. And here, hold on one second, and here we come back to something I have mentioned over the millennium, or in my case, over the generations that have been privileged to teach Torah Hashem Tamima. We suffer from lack of dates. People change their minds. I can give you one example from the Rebbe, and Yitzchak, I challenge you to tell me where the truth is. Tell me. You say of Olat Zion in the morning, Vatakot Doshe Sheikh, Vikorazel Zeviyamah, right? And what do you have here? Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Bruchvald Hashem Mimkomah. I heard with my own ears in the 50s the Rebbe get hysterical in a drusha in an agado. It was the Yotzai Drasha, and he was speaking about the fear of night. Pachat Balelot. Why does the Gemara say, Rov Chachmat Adam, he gets with the Torah he learns at night? Look into the Rambam, Hilchot Talmud Torah. What does night symbolize? Night symbolizes terror. Night symbolizes fear. Night symbolizes darkness. You're going to see, as you grow older, you'll see how many people will drive by day, they will not drive by night. Whatever the reasons are. I drive by night, but I want to tell you, I will not go to a new address at night. If I got to go and find that, you know, you guys work with guidance systems, you're in a different world, but in the world that I live in, by night I don't seek out new addresses. By day, yes, by night, not. Night is pachat, inemi tatosho shlomo, shishim gerim misavivlo, etc., etc. Be pachat haleilat. Oh. And the Rav gets hysterical and says, Tzilibdos is minig Yisrael, that at night we don't say the Kedusha of Va Letzion aloud. And he says, that was the minhag where I come from, and Motzoi Shabbos we say, Vata Kadosh, we don't say it aloud. All right? I'm Eid Ne'aman. These ears heard the Rebbe say it. You look up Rebbe Heschel Schechter in one of his three volumes on the Rebbe. The last one I put aside now to travel with him. It's a good safer to take with me when I can't carry all of Shas and Peskim, particularly today, what you go through with traveling and weight and B'dikot b'tchoniyot, Hashem Yerachem. Ah, you'll see that in the 70s they claimed the Rav changed his mind. And he said, you do say it aloud. Well, you say, what's your minhag in Square Town? Let's hear.
I never say it aloud.
never say it aloud. Yitzchak, you grew up in Maimonides. Did they say it aloud Saturday night? Yes or no? You don't even remember?
I did not daven in Maimonides.
So you davened in Dorchester. Where did you daven? Did they say it aloud in the Young Israel?
I don't know.
You don't remember. Gentlemen, Reb Cheshul claims the Reb changed his mind. I can't say it aloud Saturday night after I heard the Reb scream and shout. All right, person changes his mind. If we only had dates. I'll ask you a different question. Rabbi Rachman came out with a whole theory of Hafkat Kedushin to solve the problem of Aguna. The self-inflicted Aguna, the man-made Aguna. I'm not talking now the classic Aguna. All right? I challenge you, Ephraim. Tell me the position of the Rashba on Hafkot Kedushin Lemafreya with an Aguna. And there are at least 5-6 tshuvot that the Rashba wrote. Mendel, totally contradictory. We don't know what the Rashba's opinion was. We don't have dates. We have to kiss the ground that Rav Moshe Feinstein walked on, because in every tshuva, he wrote a date. You have no idea how important that is. He also wrote the who the tshuva was. You have no idea how important that is. With Rav Moshe, you can't get lost. You can know his original opinion, his later opinion, his final opinion. No, with the Rosh, Rav Reuben Amar says so beautifully, we don't have dates. There can be a contradiction. So what? Who says the Rosh can't change his mind? You got to admit, that's a good defense. Then another critique against the Besamim Rosh. The style is not the style of the Rosh. The language, a little different. I have to tell you, I testified in court last year. There's a trial going on about plagiarism. Nomi Rankin, you've heard the name? Well, they're suing her. To me, it's laughable. If it would be a Beit Din, the case would have been thrown out in a minute. They all admit that it's only 1-2% of what she wrote. That they claim, this woman Shapiro claims she copied it from her book. That doesn't matter. I don't want to go into it now. It'll take me a half hour to explain what it's all about. All I'll tell you is I testified in court, Bifneyam Vieda, that they're both plagiarists. They're copying from the Rav. And I gave Divrei Torah from the Rav. Exactly. It was unbelievable. I got to tell you further. I told my daughter, I said, this is the stenographer. The judge is not looking at me. He's looking at the screen in front of him, and the stenographer is ahead of me. As I'm speaking, she's typing in, and she had to be a Beis Yaakov girl who knew how to learn, because she was dressed like a Beis Yaakov, like a proverbial Beis Yaakov girl, like a generic Beis Yaakov girl, let me put it that way. And she understood I couldn't believe it. She never once stopped to ask me, I'm quoting this Rambam, I'm quoting here, I'm quoting there. And the judge is following it, reading it. So anyway, but you talk about style of writing. So one of the questions asked that got involved, and they had a big expert from Hebrew University, a professor, who testified for hours. They stopped her testimony. I have to thank the judge. Because he said, Harav Rakefet and Nitzan, they haven't even told him, they didn't want to waste my time. So they stopped her testimony, called a 15-minute recess for people to get a drink, and allowed me to testify. And then 40 minutes later, I could go home, and they continued with the expert. What was the expert testifying on? What's the chance that you will write something that is so similar to what was written before? There was one line there dealing with, you can change a pear into an apple. I'm paraphrasing it. You can change a chair into a table. That was the parallel. You follow me? What's the chance that you would write that on your own and you're not copying it? And if they were going through literature and examples and what was going on. So they asked me, what would I do? The lawyer, the opposite lawyer, who I have to tell you, I was very impressed with him, because he He was my student. He was quoting from my shayur. I couldn't believe what this guy knew. But Zahatam Nishke helped. He didn't. It didn't help him in what he was looking for. But it doesn't matter. So he asked me, "What would you do if you were on a bait and had a case like this?" It's very simple. If Taka, there's a resemblance, I would require Nomi Reagan in the introduction to say thank you for this particular idea, which is 1% of her work. Okay, Baruch Hashem, but in a secular court, and you know, people smell money, one is a successful writer, one is not, there are now another three lawsuits with another different, three different books, and the same lawyer. So draw your own conclusions. But gentlemen, what am I trying to say? And Reuven Amar says this, that not always do you write in the same style. There can be differences. A person changes. A person will write on the same topic. He may have written one way when he was 20, one way when he's 30, one way when he's 40. You do research, you can see not everyone writes the same way. I can tell you, Eitat Nemana, that when I wrote the Bernard Rebbe, I certainly didn't have the writing ability I had when I just finished the manuscript on my new book. Okay? But more than that, and here's an ingenious part which I have to give Reuven Amar credit for. Tell me, how were the Rishonim written? Look what's happening to the Rebbe. How many books have come out claiming that they represent the Torah of Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik? Gentlemen, put all our fingers together in this classroom. What do we have, a few hundred fingers here now? I don't think we have the number of books that already come out. Do you know how many more are going to come out? Do you have any idea what's going to be 200 years from now? I'm going to be around to see it. They're going to be thousands upon thousands of books. Rabbi Dr. Joseph B. Soloveitchik on Parshat HaShavua. No, how many books are already out on Parshat HaShavua? Rabbi Avishai David. Rabbi David Holzer. Rabbi Basedin and his books comes up with. Go on and on. Rabbi Heschel Schachter. Once, twice, thrice. Go on and on. Yeah. Tapes, Maria, Saturday night. Transcribe. Tell me, who's transcribing them? Michael, you got to get after Yitzchak. He's a batlan. He has word by word what the Rav said Saturday night. Why doesn't he write it out and edit it and publish it? Is he any worse than Rabbi David? Than Rabbi Holzer? Than Aaron Rakefet? Nothing worse. It's a bottle.
How do we get rid of one of his tapes?
What we have already is circulating. There's material available. There's material available. Write it out. No, gentlemen, you don't have what I'm saying. Who writes out the Shayurim? The Talmidim. Even by the Gedolei Rishonim. Who wrote out Rashi? Who edited Rashi? His daughters. Rabbeinu Tam. Gedolei Yisrael. How much did they write? How much you see in Tosfos time and again, Mipi Mori Rebbe. Mipi Mori. Who gives us over Reb Chaim Brisker's Torah? How much circulated in the name of Reb Chaim when we were kids? How much the Vevelvel, the Brisker Rav? How much circulates in the name of the Rav, Reb Heschel's notes? You don't start to realize what's happening here. You know, it's mind-boggling. It's overwhelming. So you're going to try to compare style? This student wrote this way. This student wrote that way. David Holzer reproduces the Rav word by word. Have you seen what he did? And where he can't make out the tape, he says, what's the word he uses? Unclear. Unclear, something like that. Couldn't have been indecipherable, couldn't be deciphered. You know how hard I worked? I can tell you a little story you should know. Tova Lichtenstein couldn't believe it. I have in the Rav, are you familiar with the Rav, the world of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik? A little bit. Thank God you can breathe there. Without that, Tavanus, you cannot breathe there in a YU setting, okay? And in a Chabad setting too. Maybe beyond that, you can breathe a little. gentlemen, I have there a list of what, it is very fascinating, I never told you this, I have a list of what the Rav studied with Reb Moshe, the Masechtot. So Tova Lichtenstein asked me, where did you get this? I said, let me tell you. You put out your father's writings from manuscript. Whatever I worked with was from tapes. What were the magic moments when the Rav gave a shiur, when he took off his glasses and he ad-libbed? In one of the Yahrzeit shiurim on a Rebbe Muvhak, what is considered a Rebbe Muvhak? What does it mean that he learned Rov Torato may a Rebbe Muvhak? And the Rav develops the whole idea. It means a Rebbe who gives you a derech. It doesn't mean you learn. No one learns Rov Torato with any Rebbe. You learn Shas and Paiskim on your own. But a Rebbe gives you a derech. He says, and ich hab nitz gelernt kan Shas with my Tata. Aber can I sagen was ich hab jägelen? And he started listing out. And I picked it up. I went crazy with joy. And suddenly he goes, he's talking very quickly. He's ad-libbing. Couldn't make out the word. So I have to tell you, let me mention their names. I have two friends, Erwin Shapiro, you recognize the name, was chairman of the Board of Reeds, chairman of the Board of Bernard Rebel, chairman of the high school, did a lot of good for Yeshiva University. Another friend, Barry Liebman, very heavy with the Lubavitcher Rebbe's, Agaburnin to Lubavitch. They bought me a special tape recorder that's used in war zones, where you speed, you slow, you change the tone. You have no idea what you can do with that tape recorder. It's very expensive. It's reporters in out in the war, facing Vietnam, or no, they didn't have such more recorders then, but in the 80s, wherever they were reporting, wherever the out in Israel and in Lebanon in 1982, they were using these recorders out in the field. You can drown out the background news. I worked with that tape hours. And then I picked it up. Tamura! And then I replayed it. Tamura! Took me hours, but I made it out. I left nothing undeciphered. You understand? So I tell Rav David Holzer, get yourself a good, go back in time, get a machine like this. Today, of course, they're no longer available. You're going to have to buy it from Smithsonian's Institute in Washington, whatever. But don't leave a word undeciphered. But he said, I have to tell you, you see, Reb Reuven Amar, we can laugh and we can say, why is he so naive? A Rakefet gives a good explanation, and the Sephardic world doesn't have these problems. But these are good points. Don't criticize the fact that he writes in different styles. These are Talmud in writing. Who left the manuscript? More than that, this manuscript was in the hands of Di Molina. Who knows if he didn't make changes? In other words, this is one of our problems with any manuscript we have. You take a Tosfot, you take a Rashi, many times you will see Haggah that a student is adding on, a student is explaining. They're variant readings. Students copy differently. Matan Erda opened up a Frankel Rambam. He was looking for a certain girsa. He turned not only to what's on the page, to the back, and he fainted because he couldn't believe on one line of the Rambam he came up with 72 different girsa. But it's true. It represented 72 different copyists, 72 different students. And this is a tremendous problem. Don't criticize him. Try to think how it was copied, how it worked out. Okay, so far, so good. He defends him very brilliantly. Then he does something else. And this too, it lends itself to such fascinating study. We are from Jews. We live with the Vah Hashem. You can't imagine what Ephraim has gone through to be sitting here in Gris Kollel and studying with us. You can't imagine. Michael, you think you grew up in Philadelphia and conservative and Ramah. It doesn't compare to growing up in Russia, Moscow, the communists, what went on. Well, now let's take up a simple question that I had to deal with when I was in Russia. And I'm very brief now, but to tell you I had to deal with it, I had to speak with the Rav, I had to speak with Rav Gorin. Moscow had one functioning synagogue. That's a communist word. In every community, they left one synagogue, one church to function. Yitzchak understands why. The KGB, Jewish informers. If the Alter Babushkas wanted to go to church, let them go to church. And they had informers to watch. The same thing in the shuls. Never Jews informing, and I knew Jews who were informers. It's a Rachmanis. They needed vodka to survive in there, and the only way they could get a little vodka was by letting the KGB know what was going on in shul. So, do you know how big Moscow is? You have any idea how big that city is? How many, what do you have, 10, 12 million people in Moscow? You know your Yiddish Eisgespräch. Terrific metro system. We do not have a metro system like Moscow. Not in New York, not in London, not in Paris. Nothing equals the metro in Moscow. With all due respects, the communists did one thing that was fabulous. And I said it in every lecture I gave. They were listening, they're recording, they're there. Rakepit would get up and say, it's a pleasure to be in the homeland of communism with such a magnificent metro system. I write about this in my book, by the way, that our whole approach from the Mossad was, we're not here to criticize communism, we're here to demand repatriation for the Jews, which the communist empire recognized as a legitimate cause. So now, the question of riding to shul on Shabbos comes up. In Moscow, if you don't take the metro, there's no shul. And they came up with systems for the metro. You bought tickets in advance. You sold them on under your shirt. If November 1st was on a Shabbos, you had two tickets, one for Friday night, October, one for November. You showed it to the lady. You walked by. You didn't have to go through the light system where when you put in the coin, the light changed colors. Am I describing it right, Ephraim? You know I'm not pulling your leg. The Rebbe knew the metro. I loved it. What a way, what stations, what a way to travel, what murals. Oh, wow. Under military control, under the communists. No one worked for the metro. It was the army that ran it. It was something to see. Beautiful. Now, are you allowed to take the metro on Shabbos to go to shul? And by 1980, they're from Jews already in Russia? So let's say there's an opinion that permits it. All right? May very well be an opinion that permitted it. It's now 50 years later. Communism is gone. Communism has fallen. Russia's a different story. Shuls are all over the place. Chabad owns Russia. Putin is an honorary Chabadnik. Everyone knows that. The Breslover are there. The Colin Stoliner are there. All right. Baruch Hashem. So are you going to publicize that there once were matirim to take the metro? I wasn't matir. The Rav wasn't matir. Rabbi Gorin wanted to choke me. He had a temper. What are you, a conservative rabbi? But I understand Rav Ruderman was matir. There's a rumor that Rav Moshe was matir. Am I right? Am I right, Ephraim?
I don't know who was matir.
You know, but you heard there was a heter.
My father and I, we used that heter all the time.
Say it, otherwise you think I understand. It's a badur. It's understood. I can tell you, I was in Israel. I was a guest of the Baltimore community this past summer, and I mamish met wonderful, wonderful people, and they told me Rav Ruderman was matir. I heard rumors time and again that Rav Moshe agreed it shouldn't be matir. So tell me, do you record this or you don't record it? Okay. So you see, even if a psak has not been accepted, and even if 50, 60, 70 years later, we're going to dismiss it, but intellectual honesty permits you to record a psak which might appear later in time, something shocking.
What about opening
that's minor. That's, I'm going to... that's child's play, Yitzchak. I'm going to give you something in a minute that is revolutionary. You're telling me on it, like I saw with my own eyes, Hasidic Rebbein turning on lights on Yom Tov. Saw with my own eyes. So well, what's the big deal? Light from Elijah. You know how many matirim there were, Rav Rosenberg in Montreal, every last Svadik Rav. Today we're not matir, because today we understand electricity better. It's not taking a light from a light. It's closing a circuit. And there already is an inyan of boner. There's an inyan of makib bepatish. It may be assumed the oraita that have nothing to do with havara. And I heard Rav Avadya Yosef, by the way, someone asked me from Chutz Laretz, can an Ashkenazi be somach on Rav Avadya Yosef? The answer is 100%. When Rav Avadya paskins and there's a machloikas Ashkenazim Svadim, he tells you, Svadim do this, Ashkenazim do this. He makes it clear. But as a posek in our generation, I've told you more than once, to mention anyone else in the same breath with Rav Moshe is criminal. It shows you an amaritz to the 50th power. He is there's no one like him as a classic posek in our generation. You throw at me the politician, the darshan. So you have to differentiate. Believe me, I've said more than once, and I say it today. If you vote for Shas in an Israeli election, you're voting to give back the Kotel Hamaravi, and you can to give away the Kotel Hamaravi Chas v'Chalila, and you may quote me. And if you heard the news today, there isn't a person in this room who will not say, Aaron Rakefet, wow, what insight. A vote for Shas, a vote to give away the Kotel Hamaravi. Danny, you can wolf me and quote me. Now, but you have to separate. That's the part of Rav Avadya that will not live on 1,000 years from now. But as a posek, 1,000 years from now, you'll be quoting Rav Avadya. There's no one else in this generation that comes to his shoelaces. So, I want to ask you a question. The greatest problem rabbis have faced, you all heard me, some of you heard my talk last Shabbat. You remember my talk began with the Gemara in Yevama Daf Kuf Chafet, and I said to you, more lines have been written about that Gemara than any other line of all of Shas and Paiskim, and there were big Lamdanim sitting in the room, the entire faculty was here, and everyone knew I was telling it as it was. Of course, it's Aguna, the problem of Aguna. Rabbis go out of the way, what we have lost sleep of, the Bitzchol Chanan lost sleep, what we do, la hatira guna, Kol hamatir aguna achat ki ilu bana achat meichuvot Yerushalayim. You'll find that in Shelet Tshuvat Habach Chadashot. Okay. In the 1200s, right in the 13th century, towards the end, one of the last of the Balei Tosfos, Mebutzak Meverona, I had a case from Italy, a very famous case, that a boat went down in the Mediterranean, and on the boat were great Talmidei Chachamim and many Jews. No one ever heard from them again. Their wives were agunot for many years. Their variant readings, as we said before, was copied in the Mordechai, whether it was the end of 4 years, 7 years, etc. Rabbi Yitzchak Meverona wanted to be matir all the agunot to remarry because of a principle he introduced, which is known by the halakhic rubric of avad zichro. In simple English, missing and presumed dead. Now you just think what I just said. Avad zichro. Gentlemen, this concept goes totally against the halacha. Totally against the sugyas in Yevamot. Totally against every other rishon. Missing and presumed dead is a secular concept. We are not allowed to say it in Torah because there are always miracles, as the Gemara said, the Gemara that I quoted, and maybe the man survived and somehow did not contact his wife, and if she remarries, the children will be mamzerim, chas v'chalila, that we should be party to a concept of avad zichro. Rav Yitzchak Meir Ravonu was criticized on all sides. Nevertheless, no one ever thought of censoring his opinion. It's recorded, it's cited, and in modern times, as I lectured for 2.5 years on this topic many years ago, it came back to life, and in being Matar and Aguna, in a world in which we have telegraphs, telephone, computers, fax machines, websites, emails, radio, television, newspapers. The second part of any heter is avad zichro. In a world such as this, he would have contacted his wife by now had he survived. Are you familiar with this, David? David Pardo knew this inside out. Take my word for it. The Chazdei David. Gentlemen, we didn't censor Avad Zichro. And Rav Reuven Amar says there may be shocking things in Besomim Rosh, but what right do we have to censor it? What right do we have to leave it out? And he goes crazy attacking the edition that came out 100 years earlier. Remember where we said two tshuvot were left out? He goes crazy. What right did they have to leave these tshuvot out? It may be shocking, but we leave everything in. Everyone has a right to a chiddush gadol, and we have no right to differ as far as publicizing it. There is intellectual freedom. It's a very strong point. Goes a step further. Gives another example. He says that we're talking about the Noda Behuda. Everyone crazy about the crazy against the Noda Behuda. What are we talking about in the Noda Behuda? Gentlemen, we're going to come to a tremendous problem. Are you allowed to shave? Does a Jew have to have a beard? I had a student when I taught in YU in America yet in the 60s. I even remember his name. I don't want to mention it because you'll see I differ with his sefer. And he was a typical YU boy, and he went very right wing, which he's entitled. And a number of years later, they give me a sefer from him, about 600 pages, for Hadata Pnei Zaken, a person called Hadrat Hapanim, something like that title. A person has to have a beard. I went through the sefer cover to cover. I reached the conclusion, Baruch Hashem, you can shave. But interesting sefer. Tell me, who is the first to be matir shaving on Chol HaMoed? Could you imagine shaving on Chol HaMoed and know the Yehuda was matir? Al Yedei Poel Ani. A poel who needed money for Chol HaMoed to live, to buy, to make yontif. You could take a shave. The world caved in. The Noda B'Yehuda being matir, shaving on yontif. But no one censored him. You could differ, you could scream, you could shout, you could attack him, you could criticize him, but no one censored him. What right do we have to yell at the Besomim Rosh? So he published some shocking statements by the Rosh. You can differ la halacha, but chas v'chalila that you should censor. Fascinating example, Baruch Atah.
That's the old school mentality that I
Baruch Hashem. We've got a long way to go to get to art scroll. Let's understand lumdis and learning and honesty and intellectual honesty. It hurts me because to me intellectual dishonesty is, I told you, I'm a Talmud of the Rav. It's the worst sin in the world. Gentlemen, the question of shaving we'll come back to, because the first tremendous explosion in the Besom and Rosh is shaving, and we have to talk with it a little bit more in detail. If I look around the class here, I see half the class has beards, half the class doesn't have beards, and this is a fascinating question. And you notice my generation do not have beards. See, it's interesting. Rabbi Reuben does not have a beard. Rabbi Riskin does not have a beard. Moranan v'Rabbanan, Harav Rabaran Lichtenstein does not have a beard. There are reasons why, because our role models did not have beards. But your generation already is a different generation and different exposure. Yes, Ephraim.
Did the Rav have beard?
Times in his life he had no beard. Times in his life when he came to America he had no beard. Then when he went into the rabbinate, he grew more or less a beard like you have. Look into my book on the rabbinate, you'll see a picture of him with a beard like you have. Then he trimmed the beard around and got rid of the beard and just had a Van Dyke. That was the most lasting portrait of the Rav, was for many decades. He just had, am I calling it correctly, a Van Dyke, a little bit in front of him. It's more than a goatee, it was a Van Dyke, fine. After his wife died, he never shaved again. But that was Avela. That was a very sad beard, not a happy beard. And let me turn you into a Zionist. You've heard the name Reb Moshe Tzvi Neria? No. Because of Reb Moshe Tzvi Neria, we have Yiddishkeit in the entire state of Israel. He was a Litvisher, his father was a Voloshiner, and he organized the first yeshiva high school here, or the second yeshiva high school. He was involved with the yeshiva Chesda. He was one of the great chalutzim who organized religious Zionists and to teach Torah on a very high level and be totally integrated with the state of Israel. No, who knows the rest of the story? When he became a Rosh Yeshiva, one of the first B'nai Akiva Yeshiva, or the first B'nai Akiva Yeshiva, they said, now that you're becoming a Rosh Yeshiva has to have a beard. So it was during Sfira, and he had a beard on. After Sfira, he shaved off the beard and grew the beard again. So they asked him, Rav Neria, you had a beard on, why did you shave it off? He said, the Sfira beard was availed. Now that I'm becoming a Rosh Yeshiva of the first B'nai Akiva Yeshiva, Rosh Yeshiva Kfar HaRoer, this was unbelievable. This is a simcha. You can't have a beard of availed. It has to be a beard of simcha. So that was the Rav. But in our eyes, I have to be honest with you, the Rav was clean shaven. You understand? We didn't see the goatee, whatever you want to call it, the goatee, right? Am I pronouncing it right? We saw the Rav clean shaven. But I'll come to it. I mean, it's not, I just want to show you what this. I want to end off today with Rav Reuben. I want to go into the Chuvit next week. But he's, you know, you can't dismiss him. Then he gives another example. He tells a story. And this is from the Maram Shif. You're talking about Gedolei Achronim, the Maram Shif, Ein Kleinekeit. Anyone named Shif is descended from the Maram Shif. And they tell a story that in the Maram Shif's time, someone took liver and they roasted the liver with butter. That was a big shiloh, hefsed merubah, and liver, and there was butter that was mistakenly thrown in, and lahalacha de maram shif found the heta. And part of his heta, he came up with a svara, this was the maram shif, but what does it say in the Torah? Lo shevashel gedi b'chalev imo. That you can't cook a meat in milk. But liver, when you talk about liver and butter, liver is not meat. Liver is blood. And b'di'aved, you know that dama bushal may be mutter. I don't want to say la halacha it's mutter, but there's a lot to make a case that dama bushal is certainly not an isa d'oraita. So dam is not meat. Lo tavashel gedi b'chalei imo. It doesn't say lo tavashel kabed or liver b'chalei imo. No, I don't have to tell you. Every last achron disagreed with the Maram Shif. But no one ever said you can't publish it. Follow? A third example where you have a psak which was out of the ordinary, off the track, eccentric, idiosyncratic, call it what you wish, but we allow it to stand. And then he gives another example from the Maram Shif. Fabulous example. A person had a heavy load to carry. In those days, everyone wore tefillin all day. We don't wear tefillin all day. There are reasons why. You won't know it. Although I have to tell you that in BMT, we occasionally had students who sat in the Beis Medrash Yom V'Laila learning. They didn't take off their tefillin until Bein Hashmashas. Rabbi Dardek is one example. There were a few others. He wore tefillin all day.
In the old city, there's a yeshiva.
Well, I've seen in the old city more than once. What kind of yeshiva is that?
Not of
Oakland. He's never left Israel. He remained here. He teaches for Rabbi Sabato, Rabbi Shapai Sabato. They have a high school out in the Midbar Yehuda, in Mitzpah Yericho, I believe, or near Mitzpah Yericho. They have a high school. He teaches there last night. He put out the Mishnayot. He's married to a student of mine too. So, but we don't wear tefillin all day, right or wrong. As a matter of fact, if you make a cheshbon, how long did you wear tefillin today? I wore tefillin. What did it take to daven today? It's just a brief davening, a half hour, 35 minutes, all right? That's all we wear tefillin, right? But originally they wore tefillin. So imagine you got to carry a heavy load and you can't carry it with tefillin on your hand. So he quotes the Gemara, Makam Yesh Barosh Lahaniach Shnei Zugat Tefillin. It's an interesting Gemara. We mentioned it last week. I think I mentioned it in one of my lectures recently. So how is the pshat in the Gemara? That you can wear two Zugat Tefillin at the same time. You know how he interprets the Gemara? You can put the Shel Rosh on your head. The Maram Shiv says, if you have no choice and you have to carry a heavy load, you should put the Shel Yad next to the Shel Rosh.
Who is this?
The Maram Shiv. And he quotes him as well. He says, no one agrees with that. I told you, I once saw in Staten Island, I'll never forget it, a Meshulach from Eretz Yisrael, from Tiberias, from some Sfadik Kabbalistic yeshiva, was davening at the Young Israel of Staten Island on Sunday morning. He was there to collect funds. And the crowd that came was unbelievable. Why did they come? Because he was wearing Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin at the same time. And everyone wanted to see the sight. Chassid, you all know that Chassidim, the middle of Chazaras Hashatz, they take off Rashi and they put on Rabbeinu Tam. He was smarter than any chassid. He had on Shnei Zugat Tefillin. And I remember people were writing out checks for him. So a friend of mine, Avery Gross, Avram Gross, I remember Avram saying to me, it's worth giving this guy stucker just to see the sight of two Zugat Tefillin at the same time. But that's the simple pshat. Who in the world would ever dream that the pshat is shel yad and shel rosh on your head? And yet no one said to censor the Maram Shif.
Where is the Gemara?
He quotes it in Gittin Nunchet. You'll see the Gemara.
The Gemara doesn't actually say that you should do it.
No, the Gemara says... Yeah. Shenosei Masai, quotes the Gemara, Gittin Nunchet Amidalev. You know, the Gemara says, Makom Yesh Barosh, that's why I always laugh. Today with the Frumkeit binge, you see, pardon me for using street language, but what can I tell you? So you see all these young kids, they have mirrors and they're looking and they're playing. I never used the mirror in my life. We were taught, you go like this, you see? You go where your hair begins. Now I don't have hair there anymore, but I know approximately what was. All right, you go like this, and that's where the Shel Rosh comes. You follow me? Just like this. Look what I'm doing. And I center it. I don't use a mirror, but I see all these people using mirrors. I feel like telling them, don't worry about it. Even if it's slightly off-center, Makom Yesh Barosh, Laniach, Shnei Zugot Tefillin, Yer Yotzei.
The tefillin back then with the stick.
It's filling that. You say the tefillin very small. I'm telling you, if the tefillin are more or less centered, you yotze 100%. There's an orach hashulchan. I don't want to go into more detail now. I want to give one more example before we end the class. He gives one more example. Generally, the example we referred to many times over. It's a shocking example. The Chacham Tzvi yelled and shouted, we chametz on Pesach because we Ashkenazim are a bunch of idiots that we don't eat rice. We don't eat legumes. Why don't we eat rice? Why don't we eat legumes? And he yelled and shouted, no one can understand that there's no makar. Lahefet, the Gemara says openly that you're allowed to eat rice on Pesach. Why are we machmir? And because we're machmir, we have to bake more matzah. And the minute you get involved with baking more hand matzah, there's more chametz. It's only human beings. Mistakes are made. The matzahs remain more than 18 minutes. The matzahs don't bake properly. The matzahs are not exposed to the heat properly. And they have bubble pockets. And he goes on, and no one in the world listened to him. And yet no one would ever say a mit from the Chacham Tzvi that you have to eat legumes on Pesach. So I have to tell you, when all is said and done, and with all due respects to what I said an hour and a half ago, Reb Reuven Omar builds the case. I will agree with you, he's a Sfadi, he's from the Eidot HaMizrach. He was not attuned to the problems, the pressures that the Ashkenazi faced. He was not exposed to the Haskalah. He did not know what the Berliners were. He could not understand the tragic figure like Reb Shaul Berlin, who was caught between two worlds and could not express himself. The inability for a Talmud Chacham to express himself is tragic. I told you more than once in my new book, I prove it, I show it to you. Hitler killed 6 million Jews and ruined the lives of another 5 million, including some of my most dear Rebbeim, who were Gedolei Yisrael, but they were uprooted and came to America, and there was no chance for them to express themselves. And you know what happened in YU when the Rav switched to English? That was inevitable. You had to switch to English. There's no two ways about it. But the Rav switched to English. When the Rav switched to English, it was a death knell for many Rebbeim who could no longer express themselves. Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael. They gave Shiurim in a broken English. The students laughed. The students didn't comprehend. Students are not interested who you were and what you were and who you knew. Students want you to deliver the goods. This is why I'm always in debt to the little crowd that stood around Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, in the 1980s. Almost all of them are very black and very extreme and very different hashkafa than their Rebbe had. But I'm always makatoiva because they stayed with the Rav when he wasn't well, when he couldn't really teach, when his mind at times would leave him, and they remained very loyal and committed to the Rav. And I'm always makataifa. And you will never hear me say, you take Reb Michal Shurkin, I will never say a negative word about him. I'm proud, and he's only one. There was a whole chabura, but Reb Michal Shurkin is the classic example. One time I was walking home from the Koto with Mr. Jesselson, Ludi Jesselson, Ludi Jesselson, Zeichet Tzadik Lebracha, the chairman of the board of YU, and Mr. Jesselson says to me, Rabbi, let me tell you, no one studied with the Rav longer than Rabbi Michal Shurkin. 15 years he studied with the Rav, never left the classroom. But he never sat down in class. Never. I said, and I'm like an idiot, I say to Mr. Jesselson, but it's an open Gemara, it's an open Mishnah in Sota, that after Rav Gamliel died, we sit when we learn. What do you mean he didn't sit down? He says, don't you understand, Rabbi? He didn't want to have Hana from Yeshiva University. And that was Rav Michal Shurkin, that was Mr. Jesselson's take on him. But I want to tell you, I'm very, very dankbar to these Talmidim of the Rav that remained with him even in his old age when he was enfeebled and ill, and Nebuch, all that Kohelet talks about, became a reality. Okay, so to reiterate, it's an interesting shiur. Rav Reuven Omar does what he can to defend the Besamim Rosh. He quotes the letter of the Noda Behuda. I showed you the letter's not exactly a total stamp of approval on Reb Shaul Berlin.
Could be,
but he
doesn't even enter into the whole topic of the text.
Okay, now say that. You have it your way, but
it's misused by
call it misused as you wish. I also quoted to you the letter by the Besamim Rosh's father. A fascinating letter, magnificent Hebrew. But as we say in Halacha, Ein Av Meid Al Beno. So you all can understand what Rabbi Reuven is saying. But it's very fascinating, the language problems, the style problems, the copyist problems, and then the examples of way out shitat of Rishonim and Achronim. But no one ever said, censor it, take it out. Gentlemen, tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem, we pick up with conservative Jewry. I remembered now with the wine question how the Rav, I have something very fascinating to start the Shia tomorrow. And then we're going into the most famous question of all, driving on Shabbat. We're going further. I have documents to show you, and I'm leading into Hashkafa Lamaisa, but it'll take a few weeks till we get there. To make Yitzchak feel better, beyond the lectures on conservative Judaism, I begin what will ultimately lead to Das Torah, beginning with the Holocaust, Zionism, Das Torah. If I finish it by Shavuot, it'll be, if I finish it by the time my new book comes out, this week I hope Be'ezrat Hashem to sign a contract, everything is now in place. So Be'ezrat Hashem, God should give strength and we should have the Sora Tavit Yeshua B'Nechamot. I have a world to give out. First of all, if anyone's interested, and this is very important, I faxed London today. They're opening up a school for religious girls, a college dealing with music. It'll be part of the Give Out Washington campus. So if you know anyone who's interested and is a musician, we now have art schools, we have schools to make movies, and this is the first time an attempt, and it will be successful. People who are interested in music, this is for women, they will have a chance to study in a religious environment. I sent London the information because people there asked me about it, they have daughters. This is in Givat Washington. It's a part of the large campus in Givat Washington. If anyone is a Chabadnik, this is Mayanotecha, the latest issue, and this is legitimate Chabad 100%. If I had time, I would comment on this beautiful picture. See what you gain from this picture. And if you understand this picture, you understand Chabad, you understand Chassidus. This is a copy of Bamishpacha, a recent issue. These are Kashrut magazines, recent issues. This is Kosher Spirit, the OK Laboratories. And this is Rabbi Heinemann, the Kashrut Currents. It's very fascinating how they do it. And this is the latest Hadassah magazine. If you're going into the rabbinate, this is required reading to give you an idea what goes on in the great United States of America. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.
What do you think is really a good share? What do you do?